is a lie, that the view of the Rambam is yes, the view of some of the Gaonim was that there was a Takana that said yes, and many other Rishonim disagree, either for fundamental reasons like the Rush, they didn't seem to see it as sufficient basis, or for technical reasons like the Tosfos Rit, where it sounds like he did think it could have been sufficient basis, except that we can't establish that it's actually there. And we have to worry that maybe she's just interested in somebody else, and therefore we can't take action based upon it. We also, I think we discussed yesterday, just to also fill in, so why is the Rambam not worried about that? Why is the Rambam not worried that maybe she's interested in somebody else, and if that's motivating it? So we mentioned a couple of possible answers. You know, one could say, if one read the Rush's reading in the Rambam, the answer is just that he's not worried about that, because that also counts. That's also sufficient grounds for Moed Salai. So he doesn't have to worry about it if he agrees with how the Rush reads him. Other possibilities is one that's based on a Rush elsewhere, is that we can assume that she's not going to misrepresent this position, which would grant her actually an Eishes Ish and have her remarry under those terms, and that would be a tremendous spiritual cost. So we can assume she's not going to do that. Now the question is, since that was based on a Rush, so why does the Rush himself not accept that? Because the Rush was in the context of a woman claiming that she was divorced, and we believe that she's telling the truth because she's not going to pretend to be divorced and then take on the consequences of actually being in real life an Eishes Ish. So there, it's a more clear cut. She understands the difference between being divorced and not divorced, and therefore maybe we can assume the Rush's position might be that then we can trust her that she's not going to make that up. But the difference between Moed Salai and not Moed Salai and being a justified fee of a get and not is much more subtle, and therefore maybe we're not ready to rely on that. That was another possibility. A third possibility is that maybe if there's, as Tosfos discusses, that maybe if there's no Ksuba, then we're not worried that she will try to escape a marriage under false pretenses. It's only when there is a Ksuba and everything else, then we're worried that maybe we have to look very carefully at the circumstances. And a fourth possibility is that, going back to the Rambam about mitzvah, that even if the grounds turn out to be somewhat flimsy, but at the end of the day, if we tell him that's what has to happen, so we assume that he is divorcing Adaita, that the grounds are sufficient, and therefore ultimately the get is kosher, even if it is actually the case that she was interested in somebody else. Okay? So far, so good. So all of that, really all of our discussion till now, has been about when is kfiya justified and what's the lumbus behind kfiya and the like. So now, again, I can't emphasize this enough because it's so relevant to what happens nowadays in our contemporary situations. So the assumption that we're working off of, say here in YU, that if you hear about a rally or the like, that's not necessarily a form of kfiya. So even though we have been discussing till now that there are types, there are circumstances where kfiya is justified, that does not necessarily equal that, okay, what you see happening in relation to a recalcitrant husband is premised on that, and rather it is more often premised on the assumption that the activity is not kfiya. So we have to figure out what is kfiya and what isn't. And part of the basis to see two categories is the fact that the Ramah, most prominently among the Poskim, quotes a view that is connected with Rabbeinu Tam and quoted by many Rishonim in different forms, that on the one hand, Rabbeinu Tam is the machmir not to force a divorce for Moed Salai, and at the same time, and it's considered to be significant that it's the same person saying both things, that gives it this particular authority, the same Rabbeinu Tam, who's machmir on that question, is makel, so to speak, to allow what's known now as the Harfakos Rabbeinu Tam. Presumably he didn't call it that, but the Harfakos of Rabbeinu Tam, the idea that there's certain distancings that are acceptable and would not constitute kfiya, is an important element to be aware of. So it seems like what we are talking about nowadays is under that category, a category of a distancing that is below the threshold of kviya. So we have a couple questions we wanted to try to figure out. First of all, before we even start the topic, so we asked, just to try to figure out instinctively, so if there is a line above which is considered kviya, below which is not considered kviya, so what would define kviya? So in our discussion, so we came up with a few suggestions, pretty much all of which find themselves represented in various Rishonim. So among the suggestions is something that's so overwhelming that you can't focus on anything else and you have to just get this pressure off of you. So maybe that's considered to be kviya. Maybe acting positively against someone, or negatively, let's put it that way, acting negatively, assertively, aggressively against someone, rather than just withholding benefit, maybe that's the line. I suggested also that maybe activities that are otherwise considered to be illicit, such as hitting someone and the like, physical assault, that's an indication that we're talking about kviya, especially because we know that standard kviya involves hitting, so maybe that kind of represents the line. That's something that you can't do when you don't have a legal basis, so maybe that's a good way to identify what's kviya and what isn't. And it was also suggested that techniques that are more direct and are saying it's do this or else, so that's considered to be kviya, while when it's less direct, so then that's less obviously the case. Also relevant to trying to figure out what's what, and an important clue, is the fact that the Rishonim assume that Cherem is too far, Cherem is too much. Mathematically, that's based on a few Gemaras, Pesachim, and elsewhere, where the Gemara seems to say that Cherem is worse than Malchus, is more severe than Malchus. So if we decide that Malchus is considered to be Kviya, and Cherem is worse, so then it seems like Cherem is also Kviya. And we posited the question, why exactly is that? Because it makes a difference. What is it about Cherem that's too far? So is it that it contains a very serious spiritual character to it? We discussed the idea that Cherem is a klala to drop dead. So if that's the case, maybe that's essentially invoking spiritual power to essentially kill someone or to close to kill someone. That the halachas that we find in Moikadim of how a menuda should behave, how somebody who's in Cherem, how he should behave, are reflective of somebody who is sitting shiva for himself, essentially, because of that whole implication? Or is it not so much about the spiritual power of it, but maybe it's about how the different elements, the realities of life under Cherem add up to each other, and that it creates a certain intolerable life situation, and therefore that has to be more carefully watched, because maybe you could say that other things today could theoretically accumulate in such a way that it would also be considered equivalent to fair. Okay, so far so good. So within that, so again we have this view of Rabbeinu Tam, and there are a couple of questions that are asked about the whole premise of using the Halakha of Rabbeinu Tam. First of all, there is a question, when is it justified? Is it justified in circumstances of Ma'at Salai, or is it justified only in other circumstances, such as when there is a Chiyuv L'Garish, or a Mitzvah L'Garish? So the Rambam, and for the Rambam we don't really have this question, because he allows Kfiya for Ma'at Salai, but the other Rishonim disagree. So Rabbeinu Tam, as we'll see, there are many different Gersos in Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam in the Sefer HaYosher sounds like he's saying that even for Ma'at Salai, the harfakos could be utilized. And again, that's considered to be a particularly significant statement in light of his strong feeling that kfiya could not be used for Ma'at Salai. While the Ramah, it's not clear that he would agree with that, because the Ramah tells us about the harfakos of Rabbeinu Tam in the context of a Chiyuv L'Garish, while the Ramah also discusses Ma'at Salai in a different context, and there he makes the statement that others read to emphasize that you cannot use kfiya for Ma'at Salai. So it sounds like he's not ready to allow harchakas either, or at least he's not telling us that he can use the harchakas. So that's an important question to try to figure out what the parameters are. And that itself also provokes the question of what is the status of the harchakas. Presumably the harchakas are not kfiya. That seems to be the whole point. And therefore, if it's not kfiya, so it seems like they should be able to be employed at the discretion of the Rav, and they don't carry the consequences of potential get musa. That, by the way, is the attitude of Rabbi Willig, who spoke about this, and he understood that to be the case, that it's a discretionary policy a Rav can use. And if he's wrong, if it's the wrong call, so then maybe there are averus involved in terms of embarrassing someone or the like, and taking, holding back chesed, but it does not constitute any kind of impact on the get. But it's essentially completely separate from any kind of kfiya, and therefore it doesn't run the risk of compromising the get. And the Chazon Ish, this is a suffet, the Chazon Ish considers a possibility that maybe it is some kind of kfiya, and still is justified in other types of circumstances. It seems like the weight of statements in the Rishonim is really that it's not kfiya. So then the question is again, so why is it not kfiya? So in some of the Gersos, it sounds like the issue is that the individual has the opportunity to ignore it if he wants. If he wants, he could just decide, okay, I'll live with all these problems, and I'm not going to give my wife a get. So since he has that possibility to make such a decision, so then that's not considered to be kfiya. So then presumably, that's in line with the svara that we mentioned, that when pressure is so overwhelming and so distracting, we're basically beating him up with a stick, so he can't do anything else because he's busy getting beaten up and he can't think of anything else, so he'll say anything in order to get the pressure to stop. So that's what we call fear. But if it's less intense than that, it's something that's not pleasant and not great, but he could decide, all right, I'll live with this and I'll stay married to my wife, so then that's going to not necessarily rise to this threshold. In the other Girsos of Rabbein Atan, so we see the idea that it's all about withholding positive, as the Yeshuvas Kinyan Zev understood it, that since you're only withholding services and you're not actually doing anything negative, so that's why it's not considered to be kfiya. And discuss even, let's say, a situation where the husband has been put in jail, not by the Jews and not because of the get, but for other things. Let's say the non-Jewish authorities have put the husband in jail, and under other circumstances, maybe the Jewish community would be able to advocate on his behalf and get him out. But in this case, they're not going to do that. They're going to let him stay there. So as the Binyamin Zad writes, that's not going to be considered to be kfiya, because even though it's incredibly unpleasant for him to stay in jail, but it's about the benefit of the Jewish community, and that's what's being withheld. So therefore, that's not going to be considered rising to the level of kfiya. We also saw that the Ma'arik, as is also adopted by the Vilna Gaon, seems to understand that the reason it's not kfiya is because he could leave, because he could go somewhere else. So if he's unhappy here, he could relocate, and he won't have to deal with it. So therefore, that's not kfiya. So then you have to have the whole discussion. So is it one or is it other? Is it the other or is it both? Because in the Ma'arik, you find both points. The Ma'arik also mentions the idea of it being withholding a positive rather than acting negatively against someone. So if that's the case, so why do I need to mention also that he can go somewhere else? It sounds like it's not kfiya because he can go somewhere else, so then why do we care that it's active or passive? And if passive does it, then why do we need him to be able to go somewhere else? So that's a question of itself. Some suggest that maybe it's the two together, that maybe when you can have go somewhere else, so the fact that where you are right now is not providing you with services, so fine, so that's not considered to be coercive. You can go somewhere else and get those services. But if this is the only place you can be, and you're not getting services from people around you, so then that becomes essentially an active negative component, because you need to get the services somewhere, and therefore maybe it's the combination of the two that potentially could make these activities into fear. So that's itself a discussion. A couple of other points that were considered. There were those who don't do Harchakas Rabbeinu Tam nowadays. The more widespread practice seems to be that we do the Harchakas Rabbeinu Tam. The question of why that should be. So if one assumes that the issue with Nidui is that it becomes essentially too oppressive, not because of its global implications, so then perhaps you could say that maybe the Harchakas Rabbeinu Tam, it depends on the circumstances, that could also become so intense that that's also like Shamta, that's also like Midos. That's also part of the question. How exactly are you going to define these terms? It's interesting, I don't think I mentioned it the first time, just to see an example of how another posek is generally more machmir on these things, but just to see how he defines it. So according to the language of Ramosha Sternbach, Ramosha Sternbach generally has a more stringent view of what's considered to be a get mausa. So just the way he describes what one can do in his Chubas von Huggis, Teluk Aleph, and Sinu Tavshin Pei Tes. So I'll read you his language. You don't embarrass him, you just don't honor him. You tell him he's not going to get an aliyah here or in the other shuls. He can't be a shliach tzibur. So under those circumstances, then it's not like nidui at all. Even though that's a little bit embarrassing, that anyone who notices that he's not being allowed to daven when he wants to daven daven, so there's some degree of embarrassment in that, but that's not comparable to nidui. So the ikar sheyeda shachibor ena merutzim hasnaguso. That the main point is that the tzibur should know, that he should know, it should be known, that the tzibur is not okay with his behavior. Shemis achzar liishto, that he's acting cruelly to his wife. Aval lo nifrek fia klal, but that's not considered to be fear. That there are circumstances where also you can use humiliation under certain circumstances. But if you don't have that, and you just have Moes Alayis, then you should distance yourself from him. Whether or not one can also permit to humiliate in these circumstances. So that Abezin Chayav Meshkol Heite. So the Abezin has to really consider this very carefully and figure out exactly how to address that. But he goes on to say that to use high mizonos, high rates of sustaining his wife financially, which might be expressing screaming the prenup, over mizonos or active embarrassment, Kishlo Hutter. That would be considered to be a gemusa according to him. And the fact that he's acting in a way like midas dom, so that's up to shemayim to deal with. So essentially, again, that's a position that's more machmir than many of our posting. But still, at the same time, he says that to not provide aliyahs, to not provide opportunity to be a shliach tzibur. So that's not considered to be dizon, even though it's a little bit embarrassing. That's considered to be the community saying that we're not okay with his activity, and it's his cruelty, and therefore that is legitimate. So that's the whole question. You know, are there behaviors which could rise to the level of nidui, rise to the level of cherem, and therefore maybe would be objectionable if that's the way you understand the issue of cherem? And as we mentioned, this essentially cuts both ways, that one could say that nowadays even the harchakos could end up expressing themselves like cherem and therefore are off limits, or some suggest it the other way around, that maybe we could say that even cherem nowadays is less problematic, Because if the issue is that chayyim means the person essentially really has no life, nobody's dealing with him at all, so nowadays the community is so fragmented that even if you're in chayyim in one place, you can easily find another place that's not going to see it like that. And that's certainly the circumstances that can tell you that definitely is the case, that there is nobody who's in such bad standing with the world that you can't find some community somewhere that's going to look past that. So then maybe one can make a case that even if it did border on favor, it wouldn't necessarily constitute kfiya if the issue is that you should have somewhere to escape to. Kiva? So we have to, I can't do it justice in the time slot, and we have to get to more in June, but just to very briefly address it, and I guess we have a few minutes now, enough to address it briefly, but not enough to get it into to a full justice. But the basic idea, and definitely encourage to come back in June and hear this in much greater detail, is that, first of all, it's not considered necessarily doing something positive, because there are two elements to the prenup. One element is the agreement to go to a specific bezdin, whatever bezdin it is, which, from my experience, also is really the more important part of the prenup, that itself would accomplish a tremendous amount, if not everything, in terms of reducing or eliminating such situations, because very often the issue is really venue shopping, that the husband wants to go to this bezdin where he thinks he'll do better, and the wife wants to go to this bezdin where she thinks she'll do better, and maybe one of them wants to go to the secular court. Whatever it is, they will argue forever about venue. And just parenthetically, this is really most of the cases. The vast majority of even cases that you see today, it's usually not a mustache twirling villain who says, ha ha ha, I'm just going to make her suffer forever. It's usually not like that. It's usually that each one wants the terms the way they see it, and they say, listen, as soon as you're ready to be reasonable and agree with what I'm asking here, so then the situation will be over. And the other side doesn't find that situation reasonable and doesn't find it to be acceptable under any circumstances, and therefore the situation goes on forever. That's really the vast majority of cases. So within that, so everybody can usually find either a bezdin or a court or their own arbitration system, which will emphasize their position. And so listen, as soon as you come to Bezdin X, so then you'll see that everything will be over and you'll have your get and everything's fine. And how dare you say I'm not giving you a get because here it's waiting for you in this Bezdin, and she may not want to go to that Bezdin because maybe she doesn't trust the Bezdin for whatever reason. And there are many times that's understandable. Or there are other bases to believe that it's going to be a bad situation for her. So they essentially hold out forever. This is really the vast majority of the cases, that if it was predetermined that, listen, however it is, you're going to go to this bedroom, or whatever they say, that's going to be binding, that's going to be the deal, that would eliminate really, I'm saying conservatively, almost all the cases. It's possible to eliminate all the cases. So if that's the case, so that's really already, I think, a major element of the prenup, and that itself is worth its weight in the paper. It's worth its weight in terms of what it accomplishes. And that also, alpi halacha, I want to emphasize, even before addressing, I think Stevie really asked about the other part of the prenup, which I'll come to in a second, but it's also important, I think, to emphasize just what that does culturally. Because a lot of the tremendous agnus nefesh that we see from the situation with Gittin, really it has to do with, since we are working off the premise that the Torah is fair and just, so why we find ourselves in such crisis nowadays, it's really a gullus issue. It's really that we have no central authority. We have no system that's going to apply to everyone because of our fragmentation. And as we've been seeing for the past few weeks, that there are many different types of situations where kfiya theoretically could be appropriate, but it doesn't help us because we don't have a context in which to express kfiya. So much of the issue really is the gullus reality, the fact that we are in a fragmented society where there's no central authority. So the prenup really addresses that specifically. it addresses the idea that there should be a central authority between at least the couple, at least this husband and wife, should have a pre-agreed upon place to go to that will address their issues, so at least the two of them should be in the same community. The rest of the world can have a million different kilos and a million different systems, but at least the husband and wife should be on the same page. So one of the reasons I think the prenup deserves a lot of attention is because it most appropriately, in terms of the philosophy of the issue, goes to address the problem at its roots. There are those who maintain that, oh, the prenup is only a band-aid, it's not a solution. So first of all, band-aids are sometimes helpful too, but I think it's more than that, that it's not just a band-aid, it really goes to the ikkar of the issue, that if there's one real cause, especially again, if we believe in the integrity and the justice of the Torah, then what's the real cause of the problem? The real cause of the problem is we don't have a common enforcement mechanism, we don't have a common court system to enforce the community's ideals. So the prenup, more than many other techniques, goes to address that specifically. So I think both practically and hashkafically, for that reason alone, it would be a very valuable document. And again, just remember that we'll talk about this in much greater detail, God willing, in June. Just a little bit of a much shorter version. The other element, which I think is what's driving Akiva's question more, is, and this is a more well-known part of the prenup, again, well, I think the other part's even more significant, is that the husband agrees in advance to a certain high rate of mizonos, that his obligation, that we've been learning about all year, is the obligation to support his wife, so he agrees to do that at a relatively high rate, and that becomes binding on him throughout the period of time that they're not living together. So the assumption being that the husband is not going to be interested, no matter how spiteful he is not going to be interested in supporting someone who he's not living with, and no matter how spiteful he is, this is really not a good arrangement, and that ultimately he's going to, hopefully sooner rather than later, going to decide that this doesn't make sense and he's going to end that situation. So the question is, does that constitute some type of action against him? So I don't think so. I think that it's not really either category. It's not about it being an action against him or withholding the services. It's more about the emphasizing of the reality that he's still married. That since he's married, he's obligated to support her. So he is made to realize that he is still married, and therefore he bears the consequences of that, and it doesn't make sense that he should be able to have the benefits, and unfortunately in this case it's the sick benefit, it's the Midas Tov kind of benefit of saying, okay, she's bound to me and I don't have any reciprocal obligation. So he emphasized the fact that he does have such an obligation, and from that purpose, from that perspective, it doesn't really match the types of kriya that we've seen. Now, as we'll have to discuss separately in the beginning of June, so the whole question in general of ones mamo, of monetary pressure, to what extent could that constitute kriya? So that's a fair question. We certainly do find in Rishonim, and we'll discuss this at much greater length, that monetary pressure could constitute kriya. But here again, there are a couple of major elements to consider. That one, this is not straight out monetary pressure. This is simply the emphasizing in an intense form the existing obligations he has because of the reality that he's marrying. And that does not necessarily take the form of some type of external monetary pressure. And also we'll discuss in greater detail a separate point that the Moshe Feinstein and others have maintained. This is a major topic of discussion, that even if we were imposing a monetary penalty, so at what point does that become kfiyah? So you have to figure it out, that as Moshe discusses, it could be that if there's a monetary penalty, the penalty is essentially not to make him divorce his wife, but to make him finish the process, to make him give the get, so then that makes a difference. And what's the distinction between the two? That let's say somebody is really, he thinks he's happily married, even though his wife does not feel that way, but he wants to stay married. So what Rav Moshe is basically saying is that, because it's a very short version, Rav Moshe is basically saying is that, so then to force him to divorce the wife he wants to stay married to, So then that's what we talk about when we say it's not Miratzel. And that's real illegitimate kfiyah. That's get Musa. But when he is not interested in living with her, he's just trying to exert control through the withholding of the get, and the money is to punish him for that. So then that's not something that could rise to the level of kfiyah, because if the monetary penalty is somewhat controlled, so somebody who's really in love with his wife and who's really happily married, so there's a certain monetary cost that can come along with that that happily married people would swallow. Right? That, you know, if it's hard to give a great example, but let's say, you know, somebody's married and his wife, Rahman al-Islam, becomes sick, and their medical costs, which if he was particularly heartless, he could divorce her and not have these medical costs anymore. So the average person is not going to do that, not just because he has a modest on her, but because he understands he wants to be married to her, and it's costing him money, but it's worth it because he loves his wife, and therefore he's going to pay the money. So to say that onus mamon is considered to be onus, it would have to be the kind of sum that somebody who would otherwise stay married, but is so overwhelmed by the monetary penalty, because it's totally wiping him out and totally imposing a burden that's unlivable, then maybe that could rise to the level of onus. But essentially, where it's the kind of thing that a person who would want to remain married would endure in order to stay married, and it's only influential because the facts are he's not staying married either way, it's just about whether or not he considers it painless to torture her, and now it's not going to be painless anymore, so then that wouldn't necessarily, in your emotions view, rise to the level of kfiyah. And again, that's a topic we'll have to discuss in much more detail, God willing, in June. Give us that address. Any questions? Okay, so again, it's clear there's a lot more to say about that. That's just, but you know, we certainly shouldn't end this month without saying that, so I thank you for the question. So any further questions about this? All right, so again, just the agenda, so we'll close in a minute. Just the agenda, tomorrow we will discuss Parshas Emor at the beginning. We'll see how long that takes, maybe there'll be time left over to go back to Chazara. But assuming we don't, so what we had not chazered, what we did chazer is we successfully covered all of the post-midterm Gemara material, at least in a general form. What we did not chazer now was the pre-midterm material, which was mostly about Staka, and the Chumash and Parsha material, which is a significant amount. So you're encouraged to chaz that on your own. Again, just the more you're holding in, the more opportunities you'll have to find points on the test. So it's Yudai. And if you have any specific questions, any specific preferences, then we'll try to make sure to cover that tomorrow as well. And after that, Bechina at 10 o'clock. Just a quick question. Is there anybody who would like to see a particular subject of Chazir tomorrow? Out of those things you mentioned, Chumash, Pesach,
most
people. Most people, yeah, I was thinking that also was a prayer. Okay, so maybe tomorrow we'll try that. Yeah, it actually works well with the parsha because Revi of Emor, you know, that's the Yantif and Yonim, so yeah, we'll make that the priority for tomorrow as well. Sorry?
Synergy.
Yeah, again?
Synergy.
Synergy, yes. Very high synergy. So all there.